The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, and welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio. This is your host, Richard Address, coming to you live from the beautiful, crowded studios of WWDB AM 860 here in Philadelphia. And as you know, we are streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And a reminder that if you want to touch base with us about the show, give us some ideas or suggestions, you can email the show at boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. That's boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. We have a very full show planned for you today on a very serious topic dealing with Alzheimer's. We're going to spend the entire hour here. I do want to mention a friend of the show right at the beginning before we get started, and that's my friend Peter Hecht and the Hecht Investment Group of Janney Montgomery Scott. The Hecht Investment Group, as many of you know who are regular listeners now, provides a tremendous amount of clarity on your investment process. The Hecht Investment Group provides a concierge financial consulting and planning services, and they use a formal investment process as their foundation. And as we've mentioned, clients receive frequent communication and rapid response to questions. There are no needs greater than your own when it comes to personal financial planning, and the Hecht Investment Group provides experienced guidance and an efficient management process that is important in today's environment. We urge you to contact the Hecht Investment Group, that's H-E-C-H-T, toll-free at 855-289-2168. You can visit them at hechtinvestmentgroup.com. They're also on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. And we're again happy to announce that Peter Hecht was recognized by Philadelphia Magazine and New Jersey Magazine as a five-star wealth manager for 2013 and 2014. And Janney Montgomery Scott is a member of the New York Stock Exchange, FINRA, and the SIPC. We are very pleased to welcome in studio here on Boomer Generation Radio this morning, David Friedman, a marketing director for Progressive Healthcare Services and a volunteer for the local Alzheimer's Association. We're also very pleased to welcome Judith Kate Friedman all the way from Northwest Washington, the state of Washington, founder and director of Songwriting Works Educational Foundation. I hope on the line we have Matthew Baumgart, Senior Director of Public Policy for the Alzheimer's Association. Mr. Baumgart, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me, Richard.
It's great to hear your voice, and we're expecting one other guest in a couple of minutes from beautiful Iowa. We have the West represented today and the East Coast. So I want to thank all of you for being here for this conversation. Mr. Baumgart, you work with the National Alzheimer's Association. And to begin this conversation, just in case some people who may not be familiar with terminology, could you define for me very simply the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's? Because I know they're used interchangeably a lot by some people and sometimes in the press. What's the difference?
Sure. Dementia, the best way to think about it is dementia is an umbrella term that encompasses several different types of diseases, one of which, the most predominant of which, is Alzheimer's. There are other forms of dementia, something called Lewy bodies disease, for example, vascular dementia is another form of dementia, and Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. It's estimated that between 60 and 80% of dementia cases are Alzheimer's.
So there's some staggering statistics. David Friedman and I were talking about this earlier before the show. Currently, there's approximately 5 million individuals who are living with Alzheimer's. And if not mistaken, from the statistics I've read, that's supposed to triple in the next couple of decades. And it's the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. And from what I'm seeing, that there's a very high propensity of diagnoses with women. Is all that correct?
That is.
So the first question that to begin this is, or the second question now is, Is this increase due to the fact that baby boomers and our parents were just living longer, or have we developed just a lot more sophisticated diagnostic techniques?
It's a couple of things. I think the first thing you said, that we are living longer, and there's more people who are living longer. So you've got the baby boom generation, 10,000 baby boomers a day, are turning age 65, which is the age at greater risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. And people are living longer as we have made advances in medical science, as we have cured and found treatments for a lot of other conditions, that has contributed to what is a growing number of people with Alzheimer's disease and projected to reach, as you mentioned, as many as 16 million by the year 2050.
So I want to open this up to this whole idea, because one of these issues that keeps coming up in the literature is the fact that with this projected growth in cases over the next couple of decades, there just physically are not going to be enough caregivers to take care of us, trained, qualified caregivers to deal with the impact of Alzheimer's. David, you lost your dad. Just walk us through some of the issues that confront a family when they are dealing with this disease, and then they're dealing with this, because caregiving is a family systems issue. It's not just one person. If you don't mind, just walk us through some of these caregiving concerns.
Well, one of the major ones I found was denial. I know when I thought my dad had Alzheimer's and I was pretty sure he had some form of dementia when I was driving with him and he drove through two red lights, which he had never done before. And I saw him start to get worse. My brother was in complete denial. He kept saying, oh no, he's just getting old and losing his memory. And it wasn't until I took him to a gerontologist and had him tested and put the piece of paper in front of my brother and said, here, read this, that he finally said to me, oh yeah, Dad has Alzheimer's. But it really is tough on the families to watch somebody that you've loved your entire life just completely deteriorate, literally right in front of your eyes. And I think that the biggest frustration was a feeling of helplessness, that there was absolutely nothing we could do about it except take care of him. There came a time when the family was not able to take care of him, and we had to put him in a facility that had better care for his final couple of years. I would go to see him once a week, even though most of the times he didn't know me, and I would walk out of there in tears many, many times just seeing him the way he was. It's just a completely undignified disease and an undignified death. And the fact that it's so prevalent today in our society is one of the reasons I'm glad that I am able to impart knowledge about the disease through the Alzheimer's Association. I'm a member of their Speakers Bureau, to others, and let them know what is in store for them or in store for our society in the future. Richard, you mentioned the cost to caregivers. One of the other important issues is the cost to our health care system. As the number of Alzheimer's patients increases, this is going to put a tremendous strain on our health care system.
Right. When I go out and do some workshops on the Sacred Aging Project in congregations, one of the issues that comes up when we deal with this is this is a tremendously profound social justice issue for our generation and for churches and synagogues and mosques who have social action committees having a conversation about the morality and the costs of what a society needs to do, and the allocation. It's an allocation of scarce resources issues that's really going to that doesn't seem to be discussed. I don't know Mr. Baumgart, on the national level, on the Alzheimer's Association, how this moral and ethical issue of resource allocation and cost is being handled through on an institutional level. Can you comment on that?
It's something that we address every day. Let me give you the resource allocation now. The National Institutes of Health, which is the primary funder of the federal government's medical research efforts, for every $100 that the NIH spends trying to find treatments, preventions, and cures for Alzheimer's, for every $100 they spend, Medicare and Medicaid are currently spending $26,500 caring for somebody with the disease.
Wow.
This is a huge imbalance, and don't get me wrong, I think the money spent by Medicare and Medicaid is really important, and I think there are lots of ways that Medicare and Medicaid can improve the system for diagnosing people with the disease, for care planning, and for the actual provision of care. But somehow there is this huge imbalance. We're only spending $100 to find ways not to have to spend over $26,000. And that's a constant conversation that we're having in Washington, D.C. with elected officials.
There seems to be another aspect of what David was talking about, of the denial aspect, because that's a rather profound ratio.
Yeah.
It's speechless. It's a very profound ratio. This caregiving thing, I wanted to ask Judith Kate here, because Judith Kate, you represent an aspect of the caregiving approach that I think is very novel. From what I've researched that I've seen is also gathering some momentum around and traction around the country. And that is, you are an expert. You have your own organization that uses music to work with people with Alzheimer's. And I know that you've done some of this at the Jewish Home in San Francisco. Talk to me just a little bit about what your experience has been with patients in the Alzheimer's wing or unit, wherever. You go in and you teach the music, or you write songs with them. What's been your experience? What have you seen change in their persona as a result of this?
So the number one thing is that I've been doing this now for 24 years at large with older adults. So there were always about 70% of the people that I was working with had Alzheimer's or another form of dementia. But 18 years ago, began to really work explicitly as much as possible doing songwriting with folks who have cognitive impairments because of the impact that it appeared to be having. And now research is beginning to show that this is a positive thing. This is research both in from the arts therapies and music therapies side, and also professional musicians who are coming in with their skills, or professional artists to engage individuals and also groups. So in a group setting, Richard, as you were saying, say it's an Alzheimer's unit at the Jewish Home, the first thing that we want to do is engage everyone. So we're making eye contact, we're connecting physically, we're walking around the room in a welcoming manner, and then we're using music, which has been now shown to light up the brain more than any other human activity, or almost any other human activity, the ones we can mention on the air. So music is central to our human nervous system. And when we add the impact of a human being who's facilitating, really sincerely treating each person with dignity in the room and wanting to hear whatever they say, because there is no wrong answer. What we're doing is creating a new creative context for these individuals so that no matter what their cognitive situation, they can still engage. And the biology of a person, pretty much across the board, entrains to rhythm. So we use repeated rhythm in the course of making music, and we watch people waking up in the spark in their eyes, in the connection, in the smiles, and in the joy that families are beginning to experience as we involve more and more families in the songwriting workshops as well.
You're listening to Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 here in Philadelphia. With this entire conversation for this hour today, dealing with various aspects of Alzheimer's, its treatment, its impact on families and caregivers and individuals from a variety of different perspectives. This raises, of course, a message from another one of our friends from Boomer Generation Radio, the Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice. And if you ever feel that you are worried about your parents' failing memory, concerned about your parents' safety at home and not sure where to turn for help, if you answered yes to any of these, SeniorWise is there for you. SeniorWise geriatric care managers can provide a comprehensive assessment and care plan, help keep your loved ones safe at home, screen and monitor in-home services, and help you avoid costly mistakes, as well as ease your loved ones' transition to a care facility if that becomes necessary. SeniorWise is a member of the Samaritan Family of Services, and to speak with a SeniorWise geriatric care manager today, we urge you to call them at 856-552-5166. That's 856-552-5166. And you can log on to www.seniorwisecare.org. That's www.seniorwisecare.org to speak with one of their care managers, a service of the Samaritan Healthcare and Hospice in New Jersey. So we want to welcome again David Friedman, who is the marketing director for Progressive Healthcare Services and a volunteer for the Alzheimer's Association here in Greater Philadelphia. Judith Kate Friedman, the founder and director of Songwriting Works Educational Foundation. Mr. Matthew Baumgarth, the senior director for public policy for the National Alzheimer's Association. And I think we're being joined now on the phone from Iowa, the Reverend Jade Angelica, who is the author of this wonderful new book, When Two Worlds Touch. Jade, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. Welcome to Boomer Generation Radio. Thank you very much.
Yes, thanks for having me.
Judith Kate was just talking about the use of music to engage individuals with Alzheimer's in her work. And I know in your book, When Two Worlds Touch, you have this very interesting series of writings about how society views people with Alzheimer's. You work with this with your mom.
Mm-hmm.
And you use a term that unfortunately society sees people who are in this situation as useless. And yet we're hearing from Judith Kate, and we also know from your book that that's a horrible way to look at a human being, and it's not necessarily true. Could you just talk a little bit about what you meant by that phrase in your book?
Well, I think that one of the things that I noticed when I was caring for my mother, who was in a nursing home, and so I had the opportunity to meet a large number of people also with dementia. One of the things I noticed were all of the things that remained, all of the humanity within them that remained. Because with this disease, we focus so much, unfortunately, with the things that are lost. And Judith was just talking about the rhythm that remains, the joy of music. Yes, indeed, that's one of the things that remains. But one of the things that also remains is the desire of people with dementia to be useful. I mean, that's one of our human qualities is we want to make a difference. We want to be useful. We want to have a purpose in life. And I feel that part of their purpose, part of my mother's purpose, was to draw out the best in me, to nourish my shoots of compassion, to encourage me to be observant, to give me the opportunity to slow down and walk at her pace and to talk at her pace. I just feel that there's so much there that it's up to us to draw it out. And I feel that they actually have an opportunity to give society, our whole society, the opportunity to be more compassionate.
So let me ask then as a follow-up to all of you, is there a spirituality that's present in a person with Alzheimer's? I mean, we just heard Judith Kay talk about their responding to music, and Jade talking about this experience with her mom. And David, you've been through this caregiving thing with your dad. So, Mr. Baumgart, also, is there a spirituality that emerges in this thing? Is this, as you work with a family, you work with a patient, is there a spiritual presence? Anybody?
I will jump in. The essence of the person doesn't seem to go away, but as a society, we're not used to tapping in necessarily to that essence, especially when it's our own family member. And I've had an aunt and an uncle also who lived and died with Alzheimer's. The parts of the brain that hold the spirituality and the emotion in us also are not as damaged by the disease as the frontal part, which names, which has identity. And so when we're looking at creativity and spirituality, these things well up from inside. Even when there's no more language left with a person, they can still come forward with melody, which I would like to give an example of later in the show.
Yeah, we will.
And so there's this beauty that can be tapped into, and it's really, I agree completely with the last speaker that when we have an attitude that can shift, when we can open into this heartbreaking thing and actually move aside what we thought our loved one was like and find the new person who is still there.
Mr. Baumgart, in the training, in the work that you do on the National Alzheimer's Association, I'm sure you're around and working with people who are being trained. Does this issue ever come up about, you know, the creative aspect, that no matter what a position a person is, there's still that spark, there is still that humanity, there's still a person?
Absolutely. One of the things that is important and that we always work with people with the disease on is to remain socially engaged in some manner. We have many of our chapters around the country that conduct arts programs, for example, and we have found that getting into the studio and painting is really a therapeutic and brings out the individuality of the person. So I think that's really important, and it is something that we focus on, stay active, and find that inner self. One of the other things, though, that I'd like to not lose sight of is that a lot of times we focus in this conversation and the thinking about people with Alzheimer's as people in the very late stages of the disease. And I don't want to lose sight of those who are in the early stages of the disease. As we have made strides in diagnosis and as we have been able to move the bar forward when we're able to diagnose people with the disease, there are people who are still active and engaged and have the disease, and they're in the early stages of the disease. The Alzheimer's Association has an early stage advisory council, for example, comprised of 10 people who have been diagnosed with the disease. They're very much still active. They speak out on behalf of the cause. A lot of them come to Washington, D.C. once a year to advocate for change in public policy with their members of Congress. They're oftentimes some of our best advocates when they can walk into a member of Congress's office and say, "I have Alzheimer's." That has a tremendous impact. So I don't want to lose sight I think the discussion we've had is very, very important. I don't want to lose sight of those in the early stages of the disease who are still very, very active in a myriad of ways.
All right. Well, let's. David, you wanted to say something.
Yeah. As I said, I used to go visit my father once a week, and my wife would say to me, "Why are you going once a week? He doesn't know who you are." But one of the reasons was because I always felt that there was still that spark between us, that there was some sort of link between us, and I'll tell you one quick story. My father had seven brothers, two of which are still alive, and one of them called me one day and said, I'd like to go over and see your dad. And I said to him, Uncle Milton, I'm not sure you really want to do that because he's really not the same person that you knew. And he said, oh, no, I really want to see your dad. And I said, okay, Uncle Milton, I'll pick you up and we'll go over and see my dad. And I picked him up. We went over to the nursing home, and we walked into my dad's room. My dad looked up and said, Milt. He knew who he was. He still had that spark, even though he was sort of getting to the end stage of Alzheimer's. So I really think that spark is always there.
So, I'd like to add something to that.
Go ahead, Jade.
And in the discussion of the remaining humanity, and hopefully, David, this will give you some comfort. There's research that has come out from the University of Iowa indicating that although people with Alzheimer's have lost their cognitive memory, their emotional memory remains.
Mm.
So what this means, David, is that maybe your dad didn't remember that you were there, but he remembered how you made him feel. And every time you returned into his room, you brought up those good feelings that he remembered. So these emotions remain. They're finding that these emotions remain throughout the entire course of the illness. So people out there who saying, you know, why? I mean, people said to me, I moved from Boston to Iowa to care for my mother. And people said, why are you going? She doesn't even remember you. And I said, well, I remember her.
Mm-hmm.
Just like your father's brother remembered him, I remember her. And she needs me. And people with dementia need us. And our presence, even though they cognitively may not know who we are, they may not remember that we were there, but our presence makes a tremendous difference in their lives. And what I found was that it can make a tremendous, my mom's presence made a tremendous difference in my life, too.
You're listening to Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 here in Greater Philadelphia and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. We'll be back with our guests, David Friedman, Judith Kate Friedman, Matthew Baumgart, and Reverend Jade Angelica. After I just to remind you about another friend of the show here, 50andbeyond.com, which is a content-based website for the baby boomer and senior generations. This comprehensive website covers a wide range of topics, including health and wellness, financial and legal, senior services, leisure and lifestyle, as well as real estate and design. And you can find a tremendous wealth of fascinating stories on the local and national global stage as well. 50andbeyond.com is committed to connecting you with the most highly qualified and respected professionals in Greater Philadelphia and in the South Jersey region. And once you're on 50andbeyond.com, be sure to sign up for their informative newsletter, and you can check out their community calendar for special events in the Greater South Jersey and Philadelphia area. 50andbeyond.com also offers a free Ask the Expert page where you can ask your own personal questions on a wide array of topics and get your answers straight from them. And if you're tired of reading off a computer screen or you don't like it, 50andbeyond.com has you covered, because paired with the website, 50andbeyond.com also produces a free bi-monthly printed magazine. It's distributed to over 200 area locations, and it's perfect for active adults on the go. And you can find it at your local supermarket, library, doctor's office, and other business establishments. And if you can't find a copy, you can download it directly from 50andbeyond.com or get a copy sent straight to you by emailing info@50andbeyond.com. 50andbeyond.com simplifies the lives of baby boomers and seniors, so we invite you to log on today and find out that information that matters to you. The following portion, the next portion of Boomer Generation Radio, is going to be brought to you by our friends at Kendall, a system of not-for-profit communities and services located in 8 states in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and near Midwest regions of the United States. And Kendall advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential and is committed to working with others to together transform the experience of aging. And to learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L, we invite you to visit kendall.org or call toll-free at 888-759-0128. We're back with our guest, David Friedman, the marketing director for Progressive Healthcare Services and a volunteer for the local Alzheimer's Association, Judith Kate Friedman, the founder and director of Songwriting Works Educational Foundation, Matthew Baumgard, the senior director of public policy for the Alzheimer's Association, and the Reverend Jade Angelica, the author of this very interesting new book, When Two Worlds Touch. Very quickly, because we only have half an hour left, David, the hotline number that you were talking about before, somebody wants or has a question, somebody sees something happening in their family with a loved one, they want a quick answer, they want to talk to somebody real fast, I see this. What's the hotline number?
The hotline number, and this is a 24/7 number. Anybody can call this number any time, 24 hours, 7 days a week, and it's 1-800-272-3900. That's 1-800-272-3900. And they are experts. They will answer any questions anybody has about the disease, about how it's affecting a loved one. If somebody is a caregiver and starts to get depressed and just wants to talk, dial the hotline. They will talk to you about it. So it's a very, very important resource for anybody who's caring with somebody that that has this disease.
I want to return now to you mentioned the importance of having a gerontological workup, which I know. I walked that walk too, and I know how important it is. I referred congregants of mine over these last several years when they came to talk to me about a loved one, that how important that is. Mr. Baumgard, one of the things that I really think, to follow up on your early stage conversation of a couple of minutes ago, just because someone has, quote, a senior moment and they can't remember where they left their keys or, you know, where the car was in the mall parking lot, that is not necessarily an indication that, oh, my God, I have Alzheimer's, correct?
That's correct. That's absolutely right.
So I want you to talk a little bit about, because what you brought up is, I think, as you, and I agree with you, is something that we rarely do discuss. This early stage of Alzheimer's, what should a family look for? How different is our involvement with this individual? How supportive should we be? What do we need to do if someone's living independently? Do we have to redo an apartment? Should we go in there and are there architectural or things that have to be redone or looked at, or all of the above?
I would say all of the above. There is one of the things the Alzheimer's Association has is a program called Alzheimer's Navigator, and that's an online online system that creates a custom action plan for you. You can go in, your family member, your caregiver can go in and answer some questions, and it results in an action plan and things you need to do. What do I need to do in the home? What do I need to investigate in terms of adult day services in my local community? And this action plan really helps outline for you what things you need to do and things you need to become educated about, both as an individual with the disease, if you are diagnosed, as well as family members, to make some of those adjustments and adaptations, Richard, that you were talking about. One of the things that somebody once said to me was, once you have seen one case of Alzheimer's, you've seen one case of Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. It manifests itself so differently in each individual person that, you know, we know some generalities about the course of the disease, but the way it affects each individual person is so very different that an individualized action plan is the best way to go about addressing a newly diagnosed individual.
Yeah, I think that's very, very important, because I think the popular mentality is Alzheimer's equals X, and the fact that every individual is different. Because I've had doctors on the show, and we've talked about cancers, and they'll tell us the same thing. You know, every individual is different. Every body is different. Every case obviously is different. I think that's really, really important. So I would imagine a family, once they're confirmed with a diagnosis, the more supportive, the more conversations they have within the family, the better the caregiving component will be.
And Richard, I would say not only the more conversations, but this is why early diagnosis is so important, that when you start to see memory loss, and it isn't, you're right, it's not just I don't remember where I put my keys.
Right.
We've all had those kind of moments. It's really, you know, memory loss that is starting to disrupt daily life. David mentioned very early on in the show the experience with his father when he was going through red lights. Those sorts of behavioral changes are things to look out for and have the conversation with your doctor and get diagnosed early, because the early diagnosis and the conversations that follow that diagnosis have been shown not only to make the quality of life for the individual better, but also, as you just mentioned, to make the caregiver's life and burden much easier.
When is it from your experience, because all of us on this show have had some experience with this, when is the tipping point that it is time to place a loved one in a facility? Anybody?
Well, I know for us, my parents were living independently in their own home, and my mother had several problems with her legs and could barely walk. I think the tipping point came for us when we realized that in order to care for my dad, we would have to bring somebody in at a cost to us, and it started to get very expensive. And it was when my mother actually went into the hospital for another illness, we realized we couldn't leave my dad alone overnight. He was getting to the point where his entire habits had changed. He would sleep all day and be up all night. And we decided at that time it's time to find a place for him.
Mm-hmm. Is there, Jade, what was your experience with your mom?
Well, I wasn't living here when she was moved into the nursing home. That was a decision of another person.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have some feelings about care in facilities, in that I know that my mother told me that she would rather be dead and then living in a nursing home. And what I realized is that we don't always get to make those kinds of decisions about life. And even though we might promise our loved ones that we would never take them to a nursing home, you know, I think David is describing that the power of Alzheimer's, and that eventually, as the disease progresses, we may have to surrender to the idea of having them live in a facility. And it's not the worst thing in the world that could happen. I found, you know, what Matthew was talking about, there was a lot of sociability for people with dementia in the care facilities. People like Judith would come in and there'd be music and there'd be, you know, activities, and people with dementia need to be drawn out, and sometimes if they're at home, they're very isolated. Often what they told me at the nursing home they saw is that people would come into a care facility and their conditions would improve because they had a lot of socialization and a lot of activity. So I just really encourage family members, when they're faced with this that they think is the worst thing in the world, is to really open yourselves up to, this is what needs to happen next. You haven't failed as a caregiver if your loved one needs to go into a nursing home.
Yeah, I think that's a very, really important statement, because I've dealt with families and there is a sense of, you know, have I done enough? Mm-hmm. And there also is a position where, as I've told congregants and family members, you can't do this. There's a, you're not trained to lift a person. And there's also, and I want to throw this out as well, the wandering issue, and the verbal acting out I've seen. And Mr. Baumgart, could you comment on this? When people, they seem to get, there's to be blown about it. There seems to be sometimes in certain cases a sort of like a violent reaction, an acting out. And it was explained to me once that that's because sometimes people who are dealing with this at this stage have lost the ability to verbalize, so that their only way they can emote is by acting out. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I think part of the problem sometimes too is the recipient of the behavioral outburst, if you will. This is one of the things that is important for people in who are in the system, who are working with people with dementia, to understand and to deal with. It's if I'm a health aide who is working with somebody with dementia, and I am not properly trained on how to work with and attempt to communicate, it may simply be the frustration on the part of the person with dementia, in that that person's not getting it is essentially what they're saying. And I think some of the behavioral outbursts, the behavioral issues, can be addressed through better training of the people who are working with them, because it's a frustration, in essence, on the part of the person with dementia, that the other person isn't getting it,
mm-hmm.
isn't getting what they're trying to say. And there are ways, if you're a properly trained worker, that can be dealt with, and you can handle and hopefully prevent those types of situations, or at least mitigate the effect of it.
Richard, I'd like to respond, if I might. This is Jade.
Yeah, go ahead, Jade.
I was so interested in the dollar figures that Matthew quoted about $100 spent by NIH for research, and $2,600 spent for caring for someone with dementia by Medicare. And that $2,600 is for custodial care. There's unfortunately not that much money spent training the caregivers in facilities how to interact in the specialized way that's necessary for people with dementia. And point in case, I was shocked to find out that the state of Iowa, in their training program for CNAs, there is no required components for dementia care training. Nothing. I asked them if I could have 15 minutes in their training program, a half hour in their training program, to teach dementia care techniques, and they said they didn't have time. They had too many other important elements. And I'm like, most of these people come right out of the CNA training into nursing homes. 70% of the people there have dementia, and they don't have any specific training about dementia care. I think that's the social justice issue that you referred to earlier.
Wow. Yeah.
I think one of the most hopeful things that we need to take from the arts and the research that's beginning to come forward in the arts is that the brain, we know, does not slow down with its possibility to keep making new neural connections and grow in a positive direction. We have brain plasticity. We used to think that was it. But now we know that even if you're having deficits and increasing loss, you can also have gain at the same time. And so anything that's very interactive and engaging is what we want to bring into the lives of people who are suffering in this way, so that they can become more of themselves, because we're giving them more avenues. And music is just one form of doing this. But I just wanted to say we really need to change, have a sea change in all of our thinking together, so that those CNAs, so that family members, so that administrators of facilities, et cetera, you know, are all thinking about what can we gain together by looking on the same side, rather than this is the person, I need to fix them. That's the medical model.
Right.
So how can we change it so that we're looking at imagination and possibility and letting go of what it used to be, and what is it right now in the moment?
But all of you are raising this issue that it's very, very troubling. You know, I'm a let's pretend I'm somebody sitting and I'm getting this diagnosis, and I'm reaching, like David was mentioning with his dad, a point where I need to bring somebody in to be with dad or mom during the day. The issue of a qualified caregiver, where, how do you, how do you solve that? How do you know someone is qualified to deal with somebody who's dealing with Alzheimer's? Is there a national registry, Mr. Baumgart? Is there, David? Is there something? How do I make that decision? Be educated to that, or I just take my chances? Is there a way to figure this out? Is there a registry that I can go to and say, yes, these institutions have qualified people to take care of me, or is it buyer beware?
Well, Warren, you may know of, I don't know of any registry. Warren, you may know of some, and I think the best way is to, whatever home health care agency you choose, do some research and make sure that that agency is a reputable agency and qualified to take care of an individual. Here in Pennsylvania, I know that there are various corporations of aging who can help with that process and may even provide funding for a caregiver. So as I said, I mean, this is the business I'm sort of in, and it's just very important that you identify and ask what the skills, what the education is of the caregiver, to make sure that they are qualified to go in and help somebody.
I mean, when you're in progress, yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, Matthew.
Oh, I was just going to add on to that. I agree with what David said. There is not a registry. The Alzheimer's Association does have a training and certification program for individuals, which is a voluntary program that they can take and be certified. And so it's called the CARES training program. And so you can look for an individual if they have completed and been certified through the Alzheimer's Association CARES training program and essentials. But I also think you raise a point, speaking as a person who works in public policy, I think you also raise a point that is something that our public policy efforts, and this is something particularly at the state level, because most training requirements are at the state level, and Jade talked about what she found in Iowa, which was essentially nothing. And I think many chapters of the Alzheimer's Association across the country have really started in the last couple of years working with their state governments and their state legislators to say, hey, we need training requirements in the law.
Well, I know that I just got involved with just asking Jade. I think Jade was a connection too. There's a new National Clergy Association, the Clergy Against Alzheimer's, and I think part of their agenda may very well wind up being doing some social action or lobbying work on local levels to deal with this caregiving thing. Before we start running out of time, and believe it or not, we are, Mr. Baumgart, could you just update us real fast on the medical? There's no cure for Alzheimer's yet, right? And where are we? Where are we medically, research-wise? Is there anything coming down the pike that we can be somewhat optimistic about?
So you're right. There is no cure. There is also no treatment currently available that would stop or slow the progression of the disease. There are two exciting things, I think, on the research front right now. The research field is really starting to look earlier in the disease state. Now, for many, many years, the focus has been, when it comes to research, on people in the later stages of the disease. And we found that that's too late. Any hope of slowing or stopping the progression of the disease, and a lot of drug trials have failed. And a lot of researchers believed it was because we were starting the trials with individuals who are too late in the disease stage. So the research field is really now looking earlier in the disease progression. With advances in technology such as MRI scans and PET scans, I can't read a PET scan, are able to identify amyloid plaques on the brain and identify people in the earlier stages. So one of the exciting things for me in research is the potential that what has been a failure in the past may now be more successful because we're able to conduct trials on people earlier in Alzheimer's. And the second thing I think that's really exciting in the research field is there are a lot more, and they're very big, prevention trials going on. Are there things that we can do to prevent this disease in the first place? Are there things that we can identify that will reduce significantly your risk of ever getting it? Those are kind of two of the big big general trends that I'm excited to see in research. We'll learn more in about 3 weeks. The Alzheimer's Association annual international conference this year, over 5,000 scientists gather every year. This year it's in Copenhagen to present the results of their latest research. But those are a couple of the trends that I'm excited and feel positive about, that we're moving in the right direction.
David?
Yeah, Warren, I'm sure you may know there's also a recent effort that just started that's being done through Harvard Medical School to see if an experimental drug can actually protect healthy seniors whose brains harbor those signs of Alzheimer's. And I think that's a real, real big step in the right direction.
In the meantime, we also have the empowerment that can happen with individuals and families when we start knowing that we can use every one of our senses, smell, touch, sound, color, shape, texture, in our interactions with each other, to engage and hopefully be bringing forward the neural cognitive positive reconnections, or, you know, more neural connections growing in the midst of anything else that's going on. We're talking about quality of life, spirituality, relationship. If we continue to engage and bring the arts home, if you are already doing, I also want to just say one thing. We've learned in rural areas where even in care facilities, there's far less staff than in some urban areas. We started experimenting with two-hour-long songwriting sessions, and we found that some of the folks who did not engage at all within the first hour, at 70 and 80 minutes, started contributing to the activity, which has shifted the paradigm. We actually need to give people more time rather than less when it looks like they're not engaging.
Just a reminder that this portion of Boomer Generation Radio has been brought to you by Kendall, a system for non-for-profit communities and services that advocate for and empower older adults to reach their full potential. Together, Kendall is transforming the experience of aging. And again, a reminder that to learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L, we invite you to visit kendall.org or call toll-free at 888-759-0128. The hotline number, David, that you mentioned before, why don't you give us that again?
It is 1-800-272-3900.
This whole subject is, we've just, I know in only an hour, just touched the surface of this. But it's interesting to see that there is research moving, and the experience of caregiving and the need to really check out a caregiver and make sure that they're qualified in some way. We have about 5 minutes left before we have to shut down for this edition of Boomer Generation Radio. And again, I want to thank all of you. David Friedman, the marketing director for Progressive Home Healthcare Services here in Greater Philadelphia. Matthew Baumgart, the senior director of public policy for the Alzheimer's Association. And the Reverend Jade Angelica, the author of this wonderful book, When Two Worlds Touch. Judith Kate Friedman, the founder and director of Songwriting Works Educational Foundation. And what I'm going to ask you to do is to do us a favor. You talked about the use of art. You talked about the use of music. Could you just give us a very, very brief, about a two-minute song, what that you would use when you work with these individuals? What would it sound like?
Well, it comes from them. That's the most amazing part. And so, for instance, we found out that four guys who were all in their 80s, who were World War II vets who had all served in the Marines together, started telling their stories. And one just started spieling. On the way over in World War II, I was with my twin brother in the Marines. We went all over, and we started singing it because another member who had no more verbal ability literally gave us the melody. And we went on the way over in World War II. With my twin brother in the Marines, I went all over. Africa, China, Korea, Japan, South Pacific. The war got over. We came back home, both alive. And at another point, someone else said, Hallelujah. So we have a cantata on World War II homecoming that will be coming out in our CD coming out at the end of this year. And I want to give two websites that people can look at.
Please do.
Songwritingworks.org is how you get to contact me and our organization, www.songwritingworks.org. For the larger picture, there's the National Center for Creative Aging and many links to research, etc. And regionally, contacts in your area can be found through creativeaging.org. And I'll just give you one more moment here, which is from the Jewish Home in San Francisco. I said on an Alzheimer's unit, well, what do you want to write today? And they said, don't forget me. And of course, that was very poignant. And I said, well, what do you want to be remembered for? Don't forget me. Don't forget me, because I love you. I will always love you. Don't forget me. And I'll just skip forward in the time that we have here, like 30 seconds here. Oh, when you think of me, remember the lovely things we do, all that's beautiful and true, you and me you. And when we are together, recalling happy times here in my heart, everything rhymes.
Thank you, Judith Kate. Thank you, David Friedman, Judith Kate Friedman, Matthew Baumgart, and the Reverend Jade Angelica. Thank you for this very interesting and powerful hour conversation. We hope to continue this conversation in the future on future editions of Boomer Generation Radio. Thank you very much, all of you, for joining us. To all of you, take care. Have a wonderful, wonderful week. We'll see you next time on Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 and WWDBAM.com.